comics have been scaring readers for years. Is there anyone brave enough to sit down with their creators? This is Discussions with Decapitated Dan.
This week on Discussions with Decapitated Dan, writer, artist, and self-publisher Terry Moore joins us to talk about Rachel Rising and more. Discussions with Decapitated Dan is brought to you by Curious Goods and Comics.com. Don't be afraid to lose your head over all the savings. Curious Goods and Comics.com. Where Decapitated Dan gets his books.
So, welcome everybody to this week's Discussions with Decapitated Dan. Joining me this week is writer and artist Terry Moore. Hey, Terry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how about yourself?
I'm doing really well.
The easy question we always start off the show with is just, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I am Terry and I draw comics, basically. Write, draw, and publish them myself. I don't know what publishing is going to mean in the digital age, but whatever it is, I'll do it myself.
Now, I know you've had this like long history of doing your own publishing. So, you know, how did that get started for you? Why go that route when you went that route back in the 90s? Or was it the 80s?
I started in 93.
Okay.
So, I don't know. It's a strange... Back then, there were a lot of... individuals that could make comics and get them into a store. There was just kind of a boom. Ever since Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, there was an open door for self-publishing or lone cartoonist who could come in and make a book. And I was kind of on the tail end of that. There was a big kind of a brat pack of people that came out 2 or 3 years ahead of me. And I kind of got in. I rushed in behind them and self-published through Diamond, and they listed the book. And, you know, just kind of once I had my foot in the door and once I was in the industry, I was able to stay. So that door's closed now.
Yeah.
That's like trying to get a ticket on the Titanic.
How would you – now let's pretend that you had started now. I mean, what would you see as you know – obstacles to overcome now compared to then?
You can make a book and sell it online, of course, 1,000 different ways. Your biggest obstacle would be to get into the comic book store, because the only way into the comic book store now on a national basis is to go through Diamond.
Yep.
Of course, you could go around and put them in all the stores that you can make personal sales calls to, but you need to go through Diamond. And Diamond, because of the economy and everything else, they have requirements, and there's not a lot of independent people to help you or recommend you to them. It can be tricky. It's very tricky right now.
Sure, sure. Now, let me ask you, like, because we're talking about this, like, in terms of your studio, do you have people who actually want to try to get published through your studio, Abstract?
Yes, I get that question often during the year, but you know, that means I would have to be a businessman, and I don't want to be a businessman. I just want to draw stories. So, if I had a business degree and wanted to start my own business, this would be a great opportunity. I mean, the comics industry definitely needs a publisher who will publish independent people that are not necessarily going to draw a movie or, you know, have the rights to a TV show. People that have their own individual ideas. Because the self-publishing movement went away, there's really no place for those kind of creators right now in a big way. And it would be really nice if there was a publisher that they could go to. And there are some that are wonderful, have been wonderful over the years, and they're still around. But, you know, competition's fierce. There's always room for one more.
Sure, Sure. Now, do you find, being in the business as long as you have, do you find that you still have like somewhat sizable obstacles to overcome when you do a new book like Rachel Rising, or even when you 2 years ago when you came out with Echo?
Yes, there's a glass ceiling for me. And I have to preface any comment I make about it by saying I'm not bitter. I know my place in the industry. The comic book industry is all about Marvel DC. And they're like two big rhinos, and I'm that little bird on their back. So I ride into the comic book industry in the stores because Marvel and DC exist. So I want them to be healthy. I want them to be happy. I want the stores to be healthy and happy because of Marvel DC product. And if that's the case, then they exist there for me. And then I'm kind of like the kid that showed up with the parents. But there is a limit to how many books I can sell because the attention is not, it's not about me. So I'm selling the same amount of books now that I did when I started Strangers in Paradise. The numbers haven't changed much for me over the years. It doesn't matter if I could be writing the New Testament for the Bible, and I mean a brand New Testament, and I wouldn't sell any more than I'm selling right now through direct market. It's just the dynamic of how it works.
Okay.
So I'm happy with that, and but I got to tell you, I'm awfully glad that I'm going to get a broader market through digital.
Well, let's transition to digital then. What are you doing as an independent publisher to get yourself out there?
Well, what I've done to date is a lot of prep work. And by that, I mean I've made sure that I have a presence with the website and a web store. And I network through, I used to have Facebook, but I found it wasn't very useful for me. But I stay on Twitter, and I launched a DeviantArt account and a Tumblr account so that you could go easy to find me. I found that if you have just one website address, that really is not a convenient way to do web business because it means everybody has to go to you. It's better for somebody like me to make sure that my product is everywhere that people go. My wife put it the other day. She said, "It's like we make a tomato. You don't want it in just one grocery store. You want it in every grocery store." So I want my name on every web place that I can find, you know. It's like this broadcast right now is going to go to multiple places. Well, it's the same way for the book. So I've been prepping and making sure that I have as big a footprint as possible on the web, but I have not released anything digitally because I really didn't want to go in for a lot of middlemen. A lot of them come with contracts, and I've never signed a contract concerning my comic book material. So one of the things I've really been waiting for is the tools to come to me, and I have a lot of hope in Apple's new iBook Author program. So I needed
Sure.
something like that, where there was just software where, just as easily as I can make a PDF, I can now make an ebook, and I send it straight out to all the vendors, which is basically self-publishing on the web for me in a big way.
Okay.
And
Yeah.
that's the plan.
Well, let me add in terms of that. I know this is the horror podcast, so we got to get to Rachel in a little bit here. But in terms of that, do you? Even your stuff from the 90s when you were doing Strangers of Paradise and all that, do you have all that digitally?
I didn't in the 90s. There was a long process of going back and rescanning pages and getting them digital once I got into the digital era. During the 90s, everything was camera art, you know, the old school. And I switched over to Macs, well, basically when the PC was invented. But I've been working longer than that. So it was a long process to get 2,000 pages of SIP into the digital format, and I had to do it in order to make the big book collection, the Omnibus. So, with that having been done, about halfway through the SIP series, I started working on everything was digital. So, I'm ready now. I mean, everything's done. But it was difficult when, a lot of work was done before Macs and high-end scanners and everything else.
Sure. Now let me. Okay. Now, one thing that people getting into comics now, we typically talk about is going through places like Kablam or Comics Press and stuff like that. Doing this on your own for so many years, you know, have you like jumped printers back and forth? What's your process in terms of going out and finding a printer?
Well, I have just used two printers the entire time. The main one that I've used mostly through the years has been, well, they used to be called Cubicore, but Cubicore was basically an umbrella company, and the comic books were printed by a little place in Quebec called in Le Bon Fond. And you have to say that with that weird French-Canadian accent, Le Bon Fond. And so that's the comic book division, and they broke off, and now it's just Le Bon Fond. So I still use them. They're the cheapest people to use for the big trade paperbacks and things like that. For Echo, I switched over to an American printer in San Antonio called Brenner Printing. They've been around a long time printing black and white comics. They actually printed the miniseries, SIP miniseries, back in 1993. But they printed all of Echo, most all of Echo. And then for, you know, the big expensive color books, everybody uses somebody in China. But the problem with that is that you need a big lead time. And it really and truly does come back on a slow boat from China with a lot of other mysterious contraband and crates. And you just don't know what you're picking up. So there's a trick to that one.
Yeah.
Vendors in publishing. Everybody has a story about their shipment from China.
I'm going to have to switch a question that we're going to do a little later on to that. Tell me your shipping story from China. That'll be fun. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's switch over to talk about the new book. Issue 4 is out now, and we're talking Racial Rising. So can you give us like a quick, you know, premise of what the book is about?
It's basically about a character that I went around for years thinking of my head of calling her Dead Girl. It was a girl who would not die. Even though we got to see many horrible deaths, she kept coming back or waking up in the morgue. And I had that idea in my head for a long time. And the series, as it turned out, the series begins with this girl, Rachel, waking up in a shallow grave in the woods and digging her way out. And the initial story arc is wondering who killed her, not remembering, and trying to figure out what happened to her. So these woods that I described, they're just on the edge of a small town called Manson. And she goes back into town where she grew up, and we meet her friends and her aunt. And it's really a very strange little town. It's kind of like my version of Twin Peaks. The town is part of the story. So that's it. I mean, I've basically got a very creepy town and a girl who's had something really hideous happen to her, and she's trying to figure out what happened.
Do you have like a set number in terms of print run in your mind?
I have not given a figure, but I'm sure I will. Yeah. I don't really look for anything to run forever like SIP anymore.
Okay. The reason I asked that is because I don't want it to. It's so good right now.
Good. Nice.
No, so, you know, just concept-wise, you know, you said you've been thinking about this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what made you finally decide to sit down and do it?
Well, I originally came up with the idea when I was writing a DC book, and it was going to be one of my villains. I wanted to introduce a villain that I could leave behind and be proud of, and this girl was my likely candidate. I didn't stay on the book long enough to get the girl in there. So at the time, I think I was working on Strangers in Paradise, which was, you know, the exact opposite. And I knew that when I ended Strangers in Paradise, I wanted to do something opposite. Well, when I ended SIP, for some reason, it just wasn't developed enough in my mind, and Echo, the idea for Echo went out instead. So I went sci-fi. But I knew Echo was going to be high concept and all that. So I ended up doing Echo for 3 years. And in the meantime, while I was doing sci-fi, people were saying, all they talked about was, oh, gee, you did a romance series and a crime series, and now you're doing sci-fi. So you must be like a romance drama sci-fi guy. And I'm thinking, no, I'm really a horror guy. And you just don't know it yet. You have no idea all this creepy. I needed to let these creepy scenes kind of like fester in my head and develop in my head. And I needed more than just this dead girl idea. And bit by bit, as I was working on the sci-fi series, I started thinking of more horrible scenes and what creepy was to me. And, you know, you have to kind of process to get rid of all the blatant plagiarism. And, you know, an idea may start off looking exactly like the monsters, but by the time you finish thinking it through, it's yours, you know. So I had to do that. I had to process these ideas. And finally, I ended Echo, and, man, I couldn't wait to get started on Rachel. And if you go back and look at it, there was no time between the end of Echo and the start of Rachel. I just dove right into it because I was so excited.
And a lot of people – now, I remember when the first issue came out, a lot of people were wondering if Echo would somehow tie in.
Well, and the answer is yeah, because – like Robert Heinlein, who I got the idea from, I decided all my books happen in the same country at the same time. So, yeah, these characters can run into each other, and the ripple effects can take place.
So you're creating a Moreverse.
Yeah, it's a Terryverse.
A Terryverse, okay.
Yeah. So, like, when there was a big explosion in Echo, I was thinking about, gee, I wonder what the girls in SIP thought about that. Or I'm working on Rachel, and any characters from those first two series could be driving through town and have a car breakdown and be stuck there. So who knows?
Now, okay, well, you say that. Do you have them taking place in the same state?
No, Manson is in a different state. Echo was in California. SIP was mostly in Houston. And then Manson, I'm trying to decide whether I want my creepy town of Manson to be in the state of Washington or in Ohio or in Massachusetts. I've got it down to those three.
Okay. I want to talk art for a second here. Looking at the pages of the book, can you explain the white, I'm going to call it a bubble, behind the panels?
Mm-hmm. It's something I started doing when I was drawing stories back when I was 19. I would do the borders as well. Something would be in the borders. And when you do that for a while, you think, okay, well, now it's going to have this kind of border for this mood or that mood, like a mood ring, or divide them by chapters, what the border's doing. And you'll see other creators play with that from time to time. Well, I knew that when I was doing SIP, the black, if it was a really high drama scene, the borders would go black. And in Echo, the sci-fi series, everything was clear white and regimented because it was more engineering looking, you know. But in Rachel, I knew that everything would be dark. Everything would be black. And I don't want to say gothic, but just the black insinuates that we're falling into this story. You know, it's a hole we're falling into, or it's just, I don't want any sign of hope on the page. The only hope should come from heroism of a character, but not from any. I wanted to create this feeling like when you walk into a goth teen's bedroom and it's painted black and, you know, all that stuff is there and you just immediately catch the mood, you know? So that's what it's for. It's there for mood. And that white space in the middle is kind of works like a vertigo effect. I don't want to make you dizzy, but it kind of keeps you bullseyed on the page, you know.
Sure.
And it changes, you know, depending on what the gutter lines, which direction they're going, there can be interesting things going on there, emblematic things or subliminal crosses and things like that that I like. So you find a lot of, I don't know, maybe someday it'll actually, I can actually give somebody a seizure with it. Who knows?
The secret goal. Now, you said you had mentioned that, you know, I'm not a romance guy, I'm a horror guy. You know, what is it that just draws you to the horror?
I don't know. And I say that in all honesty. The first short story I ever wrote at about the age of 12, it was a little horror short story that ended up with the corpse in a closet being covered in fire ants. And I remember I didn't collect comics. I collected horror memorabilia from my favorite movies from the 40s and the 50s and the Hammer films from the 60s. It was just one of the things that kids of my generation could get into, and we loved it. There was the horror magazines, you know, the fanzines and all that. So I don't know. I just come by it honestly, just really enjoyed it. I think there were elements in all the elements that I like in stories, such as a really beautiful woman and a guy who's in trouble way over his head. And the fact that humanity is really only surviving on this planet day by day by the grace of something. We couldn't handle the slightest big nature problem or a big meteor, you know. It's just also tenuous. And so accidentally stepping into a pothole of reality that we are trying not to look at, I like that, you know. I like horror that's terror-based. You don't have to go out into space to get scared. You could just look a little too hard at our own planet and find something that's more than you can handle. I like those kind of stories, you know.
Sure.
I like Roger Zelazny and Harlan Ellison and Robert Heinlein and the short story writers of the 50s and 60s who would delve into things like that.
Well, let's talk about that. You kind of mentioned, you know, growing up. Were you into comics growing up, or just in general? Not, it doesn't have to be horror. Were you into comics?
Yeah, I was. I did. I mean, I followed the main stuff. So I have my Spider-Man sentiments and my Superboy sentiments, things like that. They've been there from the beginning. I just never was, like, you know, a big geek about it. I wasn't like Mark Waid, who loved it sorry.
Oh, that's him calling right now. He knows.
So there are phones in this place. Yeah, he actually, Mark Waid bugs my office, and he can tell when I talk about him. But yeah, I wasn't a big geek. I didn't know who the artists were or any of that. But I did know who my favorite horror actors were, you know. I didn't know who drew Spider-Man, but I knew who Peter Cushing was and all that, you know. So
sure, sure. Now, you know, transitioning today, do you read comics?
It has to be really good.
Okay. Well, how do you determine that then?
Well, it's hard for me to draw a comic with bad. I mean, to read a comic with bad art. Like, it was hard for me to read Sandman, the series. It's a great story, but so much of the art was just not to my taste. You know, I like more illustrative Norman Rockwell, Alex Raymond-based art. More, you know, semi-realistic.
Sure.
But I have enjoyed, you know, like the more experimental guys who are brilliant, like the guys who, like James Jean or... the guys who drew 30 Days a Night, or, you know, those guys, the painters who find their own way of illustrating. I can get into that.
Yeah, things that, you know, kind of stand out just a little bit more.
Yeah, if it's funky looking because they're brilliant and they know what they're doing, that's cool. If it's funky because they're drawing over their head, that's, you know, that's hard for me to read.
Are you a fan of the traditional superhero style?
No.
Big muscles and big breasts.
No, I'm not. And I wasn't able to appreciate the Image School, although I could see that the standouts like Todd McFarlane and Jim Lee, I could see where the value was and the appeal. I could see the appeal. And then people like Michael Turner, they didn't necessarily look so good on the book, but when you go to an original art booth at a show and look at Michael Turner art in person, it's the most gorgeous stuff you've ever seen in your life. It just, to me, it didn't translate so well when it was shrunk down 50% and colored and all that, you know. But so some of the art is just brilliant. It just depends on what format it's in. But for me, I was more about, my favorite artists were people like Playboy cartoonists or National Lampoon cartoonists or illustrators from the magazine era. You know, those kind of guys.
Sure, sure. Would you say like Sergio Argonis?
Yeah, I loved him because I loved Mad Magazine growing up. I loved humor, and he was brilliantly funny. Been a fan of his forever. So I mean, I've been reading his little doodles and stuff like that since I was 10. And now that I've made art my life, I appreciate what he does even more. The fact that it's all spontaneous and he can do that anytime, any place, anywhere on the spur of the moment. So I can appreciate that. He's really tapped into his muse.
Well, you know, you brought up shows. So what if I were to run into you at a show and I came across your table, what would you typically have for sale? What can people expect when they see you?
Well, I have my collection books. I don't carry the single issues anymore, but you would find the trades and the big collections and my special sketchbooks. You would find some doodads like T-shirts or coffee tumblers and lapel pins. That's basically it.
Okay. Do you sell prints or anything like that?
I do. I usually have a couple of prints that I sell cheap for $10 a piece. They're always black and white. And I have that because, you know, a lot of people want a piece of art, but I have my original art for sale there. I'll always have a big art book, but you know, interior pages go for $425 and a cover is $1,000. So, only special collectors end up buying them. So the print is a nice thing to have, so that people can walk out with a large piece of art.
Sure. All right, now here comes the big question. I'm going to put you on the spot because I didn't prep you for it.
Okay.
You got to tell me the most horrific thing that's ever happened to you at a convention.
Horrific?
Yep.
Oh, man. Okay. Anybody who knows me knows my wife, Robin. I mean, we're like John and Yoko. We're never more than 6 feet apart. So at the shows, Robin's been in every show, and we're always at the booth together and all that. So there I am, Mr. Married Man, Family Guy. I have kids, Family Guy, you know. And the older you get, the more you don't want anybody thinking of you as, oh, that creepy older guy. So you want to be Mr. Upstanding and, you know, like, oh, he's so nice. Well, so we're at San Diego, which is, you know, deep, deep into the California weirdness. And one year, you see all the cosplay stuff going on and all the costumes. Well, one year, there was a girl walking around in her underwear. And what made it so unique was that she was 6 feet tall, gorgeous, really well built, beautiful, and the underwear was very skimpy and nude colored. And the only thing she had besides a bra and panties on was a big white bunny tail stuck on the back of the short G-line panties.
Okay.
So this girl is walking around, and the buzz starts around the aisles. Have you seen this girl? And everybody, you know how it is, the word travels around school. Everybody in school knows within 10 minutes that there's something going up and down the hall. So she comes to the independent aisle, and there she is. And everywhere she goes, the crowd clears out, you know, like they do for good costumes. Well, she comes to my table, And she starts talking to me. And she talks for 10 minutes. So for 10 minutes, I am looking at this gorgeous, almost naked girl, and I have to maintain eye contact for 10 minutes. She maintains eye contact. She never looks away, so I can never get a quick glimpse down. I have to maintain eye contact, so, which is really hard for a guy to do, really hard. And she's leaning on the table talking to me. And behind her, the booth behind her across the aisle, which is only, you know, like 6 feet away, is full of guys, and all the guys are making fun of me and making big gestures and distracting me. And there is a pantomime going on behind her, and she is oblivious. And there is the crowd has cleared out 10 feet circle, like I'm in the middle of a police zone. So I've got like 100 people watching me try to keep contact with a naked girl while the guys behind her are all getting me to do, try to break, crack me up or whatever. It was the hardest 10 minutes of my life. And to my left is my wife waiting for me to do something to embarrass her on YouTube. So it was, in a way, because it was the most uncomfortable 10 minutes at a con I've ever had, it was, I guess I would have to say, it was horrible.
Okay. Speaking of shows and stuff, any appearances or any shows coming up that you're going to be at?
Well, the next thing I'm doing is in February. I'll be at Comics Pro in Dallas, February 10, 11, to meet with retailers and try to see what we're all going to do for 2012. Beyond that, I am only doing San Diego in the United States. Last year and the year before, I went to all the shows, 17 shows a year. So this year, I'm only going to do the one big U.S. show and then do a couple of European appearances and really focus on making more books, being in the studio more.
Very cool. Very cool. We'll drop some websites on us. We'll call it an interview.
Fantastic. You know, my web name is the same wherever I go. It's Terry Moore Art. So if you do terrymooreart.com or go to Twitter and type in Terry Moore Art or go to DeviantArt or go to Tumblr, you'll find me. There I am.
That's the easiest way to do it.
Mm-hmm. It is. I'm easy to find. Just remember that and you can and plug it in everywhere you go, and I'm probably there.
Very cool. Well, Terry, I want to thank you for taking the time. You know what? I wanted to mention. Hopefully by the time people hear this, they can still pre-order Rachel Rising Volume 1.
Yeah, that's going to be out in March. So I'm actually working on Issue 6 right now, which is the first Rachel number 1 book will have the first 6 issues. So I'm working on the finale to the first book right now. By the time this broadcast comes out, I'm pretty sure 5 will be in the stores.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I hope everybody can check it out because it's a book that I'm highly recommending.
Thank you.
I'm still waiting. I'm going to try to like wait till the trade to do the full review on the first story arc.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. So, so Terry, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us here on Discussions.
It's a pleasure, Dan. Thanks for having me.